I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. My guest this episode is one of Politico's 10 names that matter on China policy, Elizabeth Economy. Liz is director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a visiting fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and of course, an acclaimed author. Her most recent book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. I start our conversation by getting Liz's take on the escalating tensions surrounding the U.S.-China trade agreement and the Huawei situation specifically. Huawei is one of China's biggest corporate success stories and the world's largest provider of telecom and networking equipment. But on December 1st of this year, the company's CFO and heir apparent, Mengwan Zhou, was arrested while on a business trip in Canada. She was charged with defrauding a number of banks in connection with sanctions against Iran, and this on the back of other U.S.-led accusations that Huawei acts as a proxy and a spy for the Chinese government. I asked Liz what's really at stake here and what should we expect in coming weeks.
As I'm sure everyone is aware, the United States requested that the Canadian government hold Mengwan Zhou, who is the chief financial officer of Huawei and also the daughter of the founder and head of Huawei, because the U.S. believes that she committed fraud. And the fraud was basically a fraud of U.S. financial institutions, that she misrepresented to them that a Hong Kong company named Skycom, which had been a Huawei subsidiary and the U.S. believes is still tied to Huawei, that this was used in some ways to evade U.S. sanctions on Iran, and she involved U.S. banks in this process. And so we don't have all the details of the case, but that's sort of the general nature of the accusation, and the Canadian government, which has an extradition treaty with the United States, complied with the U.S. wish. And so while Meng was traveling to Mexico through Vancouver and the plane had stopped, they detained her. In response, the Chinese government has now detained three Canadian citizens. The first was a person who worked, was a former Canadian diplomat, also worked for the International Crisis Group, lived in Hong Kong, and was just visiting Beijing on a legitimate visa. The second was someone who lived in China and ran a company that took visitors to North Korea. And the third, we don't know anything about at this point, but we have heard the third Canadian citizen has been detained.
But Liz,
so that's the situation as it stands.
Yeah, and Liz, but even before this, I mean, the Huawei has been stuck in the craw of U.S. policymakers since 2012, when the House U.S. Intelligence Committee came out with a report that, you know, suspected Huawei of perhaps placing listening devices or listening capabilities in its technology. This has been going on for a while. Is this related or not related, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to say that it is related directly. I mean, the United States, you know, just a short while ago also put a sanction on ZTE, which is another Chinese telecommunications company, similarly for evading U.S. sanctions for Iran. So I think that there is a legitimate issue around U.S. law that both these companies are likely that they're coming into the crosshairs of the United States because, you know, they're not abiding by U.S. law. You know, is there a larger issue around Huawei? Absolutely, in the United States. There is, and there's a lot of concern that, you know, Huawei technology is being put into telecommunications infrastructure, you know, not in the United States, but in many other countries with, you know, which the United States does business. Some of our closest allies, like the United Kingdom, you know, has extensive, you know, Huawei technology in its infrastructure. Yes, there's a lot of concern that because of the close relationship between Huawei and the Chinese government, that Huawei will be, you know, doing things for the Chinese government that will be against U.S. security interests.
I just want to be, you know, I went back and read that report, actually. I you know, it's not great early morning reading, but I did it anyway. But really, when I looked at the findings and the recommendations, the issues weren't explicitly There was no explicit evidence to show that this was the case, but there were concerns. And many of the recommendations were around using, for instance, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. or CFIUS in order to vet future U.S. tech acquisitions, discouraging or even potentially intervening to prevent commercial partnerships, force the Chinese companies to be more transparent in reporting what's going on. So it was just really, if anything, giving air to suspicions, but there was nothing condemning in that report that I saw. Has there been anything since that definitively shows that Huawei, in fact, is doing this?
I think the one definitive instance that we've seen of Huawei doing the Chinese government bidding in terms of you know, using its technology to help the Chinese government basically spy is in the African Union building. So, you know, Huawei did the technology there, and it was proven basically that, that building had many listening devices put in that the Chinese government was accessing. So I think that's the one definitive example that I know of in terms of Huawei, you know, using its role as a technology company in service of Chinese intelligence operations. I think it's important, though, to know, certainly since 2012, that the Chinese government has taken a number of steps that only increase the demands on companies like Huawei to be in service of the Communist Party national security interests, right? They passed a law that basically said that all companies, you know, have to support Chinese intelligence operations. The Chinese government under Xi Jinping has pushed to have party committees, right? So the members of the Communist Party that are members of firms take a much stronger role in the governance of companies, especially big tech companies like Huawei. So to the extent that Huawei was ever technically a private company, the Chinese government, the Communist Party at this point, has basically ensured that no Chinese company, private or state-owned, is completely independent, can act independent of, you know, Chinese government interests. I think that's a really important distinction, you know, something that's, you know, really been pretty transformative just over the past 3 to 4 years.
So it's no mystery that there's been strong Chinese government involvement in large Chinese corporations. But what you're saying is because of Xi's recent moves to consolidate power and basically broaden his efforts to control, he's imposed on some of these Chinese companies the type of capabilities or the type of requirements that prior they were not responsible for. Do I understand that correctly?
Right. So again, the new national security law that was passed in 2017 says explicitly that companies have to support, cooperate, and collaborate with the government in national intelligence work. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one thing that's changed. The second thing is that, again, these party committees, right, which used to basically just be the party members in a company would gather together to maybe read Xi Jinping's speech and talk about it, or maybe they'd be involved in the local tree planting campaign, you know, now are have become activated, right, as decision-making bodies in things like doing investments, like where a company should invest. So they become active participants, you know, in the governance, in the board governance of these companies, right, with recommendations that the chairperson of the board of a company like Huawei will be the secretary, will be the head of the party committee. So a far greater direct linkage between party leadership and the leadership of any company. And there's even a move, you know, for the party to take a 2% stake in the major technology companies in China, like Huawei, like Alibaba, like Tencent.
So separate from this recent incident in Canada with the arrest of the Huawei CFO, you're saying that the U.S. government may be reacting more to the Chinese government's impositions as opposed to any specific activities by Huawei as a company?
I mean, I think, you know, that in fact could be the case. And I think it bears noting that, you know, if we're really going to talk about the evidence, right, that, you know, Meng Wanzhou also, you know, held one of her many passports, you know, she's rumored to have between 7 and 11 different passports, Hong Kong and China and mainland Chinese passports, that one of them is a passport that is only given to state-owned enterprise, senior officials of state-owned enterprise or the party. And so the fact that she holds one of those passports, I think, is significant.
You know, Liz, if you look at the history of telecommunications equipment companies, I mean, many started out as government-backed or government-owned. I mean, our very own AT&T, you know, and I guess Alcatel-Lucent has had some. And then even, I'm not sure on this, but Nokia and Ericsson, I think, had some government backing or support. Over time, they privatized. But is this possibly just part of a developmental cycle of a Chinese company as it starts to go global?
Well, it would only be part of the developmental cycle if it were moving in the opposite direction, right?
Fair enough.
So it would be, if we're following a trajectory of the United States or, you know, European companies, then it would be becoming, you know, less engaged with the government, not more engaged. And what we're seeing is the exact opposite hold true. And, you know, I think it's important to note that a lot of Chinese private entrepreneurs are unhappy with the direction that the Chinese government is moving because they recognize that their companies, you know, first of all, they don't necessarily think that, you know, these party members have any business making any, you know, sort of investment decisions. But also they recognize that as they go global, they are viewed as agents of the Chinese state. And, you know, for many of these, you know, tech leaders, they view themselves as, you know, Bill Gates, and you know, they don't want to be seen as an agent of the Chinese government. I think it's unfortunate on a number of fronts, but this is the direction the government is moving in China.
And just, you know, for listeners, I mean, when we speak of Huawei or ZTE, we're not talking about fly-by-night businesses. Huawei, I think, is a $92, $93 billion business, almost twice the size of Cisco and growing and gaining market share year on year for the last decade. These are big, powerful, important organizations with strong, forward-thinking technologies, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
Huawei's revenues are going to be, I think, over $100 billion this year, and you know it has 15% of the global market in cell phones, and you know, second only to Samsung. And I mean, it's they have a huge mobile money platform in Africa with 100 million users. They're doing cloud services. They're involved in surveillance systems. You know, they're across the board. You know, leaders in 5G. At this point, so no, you're quite right. And they invest a lot in research and development. They do many of the types of things and are involved in many of the areas of research that, you know, the best leading companies globally are.
So in an era when the U.S. and other countries have complained about access to the Chinese market, Chinese protectionism, the China firewall, could this be, or is there a bit of a reaction to this? Could this be commercial to some degree, some of this pushback on Huawei?
So, you know, it could be. I guess I don't see it that way. I think that this administration, the Trump administration, I think it's really important to look at their overall sort of China policy and understand what's going on in that context. Because in part, the overall policy of this administration is to, you know, hold China to account for everything. Right. And whether it's on the Iran sanction issue or cyber espionage or influence operations or, you know, what China's doing in Xinjiang, you know, in the far western autonomous region in terms of human rights or the Belt and Road Initiative and financing and, you know, what the administration has called, you know, predatory, you know, lending policies of China to some developing countries. All of these things, the administration is kind of on attack across the board. And, you know, we are in the midst, frankly, the United States and China, of trying to resolve a pretty significant issue in terms of, you know, a trade war, right? The U.S. set, you know, very significant tariffs on Chinese goods. The Chinese responded. We're looking for structural economic reform in China. And, you know, in the middle of this, just announced this 90-day pause, right, in this tariff war, where we're trying to negotiate and come to some kind of, you know, positive agreement, we have this announcement of Meng Wanzhou and Huawei and the detention of Meng Wanzhou. So, you know, I can tell you that I was with a U.S. government official right when this was announced, and he's someone that one might have imagined knowing about this, and he had no idea. You know, what he said is the Justice Department operates independently. That's important to bear in mind.
This is Inside Asia. You're listening to my conversation with Elizabeth Economy, Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. More in a moment. I'm Steve Stein. Let's get back to my conversation with Liz Economy. We've been talking about the ongoing U.S.-China trade war and the current standoff with Chinese telecom equipment maker Huawei. Before the break, Liz described what she sees as a Trump administration strategy to hold China accountable on all fronts. I start off by pressing her on this. Is the Trump administration executing a coherent foreign policy aimed at containing China, or is it doling out provocations to get a reaction?
First of all, let me take issue a little bit with the use of the word containment, because I don't see, you know, pushing back in the South China Sea or on Belt and Road or on cyber espionage or, you know, in Xinjiang human rights violations. I don't see that as containment. You know, I see this, you know, as saying, you know, here are areas where, you know, either China has definitively, you know, broken laws or where Chinese practices, and in the case of, you know, Xinjiang, you know, really fly in the face of very fundamental core values, not just of the United States, but of what's embodied in the UN, you know, charters. And so when I'm talking about U.S. holding China to account, that's what I mean. You know, I don't think this is about containing China. If you want to use the word containment, maybe you use the word, you know, containing bad behaviors or something like that. I don't think it's about containing China. You know, the United States is not, for example, saying we're not going to trade with China. You know, that's not what's going on.
Okay.
It's saying we want free and fair trade. We want a level playing field, right? So I think that's very different than saying that the U.S. is trying to contain China. I don't think that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. And but human rights, it's interesting you raise that one, because if it appears they're being quite vocal on Xinjiang and what's happening there, what about Myanmar? What about the Philippines? What about the human rights violations there? In fact, Trump appears to be relatively passive with those governments. Why is he so concerned about the Uyghurs in Western China?
Yeah, so I don't think President Trump is concerned at all about the Uyghurs in Western China, if I'm going to be quite frank, but I'll tell you who is concerned, and that's Congress, the U.S. Congress. And so it's really the U.S. Congress, you know, and in fact, historically, it's been the U.S. Congress that has been most active on the issue of human rights in China. And actually, I will say that Secretary Tillerson, back when he was Secretary of State, was very vocal and active on the Myanmar issue. And so I don't know that Secretary Pompeo has, you know, picked that up from Secretary Tillerson, but Congress has also been focused on the Myanmar issue and the role of Aung San Suu Kyi. So I think, you know, I'm not making any claim about President Trump and his commitment to human rights. I think you can look at, you know, what is happening in our own country and and certainly what's happened with the immigrants and separation of, you know, families, you know, in that regard. But I think Congress has been quite inflamed on it.
Liz, when you reflect on, you know, in your experience and when you've seen different administrations, you know, approach the China problem or the China challenges, and then you look at what's going on right now, Huawei, human rights, trade, tariffs, whether it is concerted and coordinated or not, I guess the bigger question is, in your experience and looking historically at what has worked, will this work?
I would say, if you look historically, you know, I don't subscribe to the notion that, you know, some of my good friends and colleagues, Eli Ratner and Kirk Campbell, have put out there that engagement has failed. I think that, you know, the United States policy of, you know, looking at China as an opportunity, you know, bringing China, you know, helping to bring China into the international system, you know, working with China to help develop the domestic laws and regulations, as well as, you know, embracing Chinese civil society and partnering with you know, Chinese non-governmental organizations. All of that, I think, has been successful in many respects. I mean, across the board, and it's not just the United States, by the way, this is, you know, European countries and Japanese and the Canadians and, you know, many others, many advanced economies as China has been developing have been, quote, engaging with China in exactly the same way that the United States has been. And I think the, you know, the Chinese at various points in time have been extremely receptive to this. I think Xi Jinping is less receptive, right? And we've seen that in terms of laws and restrictions that he's put on the opportunity for engagement with Chinese civil society, for example, the management of foreign NGO law. I think we're dealing with a very different China under Xi Jinping than we dealt with pre-Xi Jinping. Mm. And so I think there's a Chinese scholar, Wang Jise. He's one of the leading scholars of the United States-China relations in China. And he had an interview recently where he said, U.S. policy has been pretty consistent for 200 years, right? And, you know, many times China has rightly pushed back against some elements of this. But if we're looking for why U.S. policy has changed now under the Trump administration, it's because China has changed its policy. And so I think that's important to recognize. And if what you're asking me is, are we likely to be successful? I don't know the answer to that, but I will tell you that I've had a number of Chinese sort of liberal intellectuals and moderates and others come through my office recently who've said that President Trump is their best hope, which I think is incredible. But they really believe he's their only chance, you know, pushing back against Xi Jinping, constraining what they see as just a very repressive and in some respects politically regressive leader.
And I see that. And I think we've had other guests on that would say very similar things in terms of, it's good to, have a bit of a sounding board or place some pressure on China. I guess what feels different to me, Liz, is if you look at the previous Cold War or look at, our response to Al-Qaeda, we have created these enemies in the world. And this time it feels different, if only because we advocated capitalism. China embraced it. That's a good thing for the world and a good thing for us. But now that they're becoming successful at a hyper rate, all of a sudden the reaction feels a little bit overstated. Now, maybe that's just timing. And maybe with Xi's, consolidation, there's some confusion about which way China is going. But I'm just wondering, when you look at Cisco losing market share, Ericsson, and others, Nokia, all falling, why Huawei, ZTE, and other Chinese-based companies are really booming. I'm just wondering if anybody is talking about the potential or the perceived threat of a commercially successful China.
So I am sure that there are people who are thinking, wow, China's becoming so much more competitive. We've got to get moving. We've got to get ourselves in gear. Absolutely. And you can look at, the recent book on the, AI superpowers, right, by Li Kaifu. Mm. Who, heads the Sinovation Ventures in China, and to know that, there's a big competition going out there. I don't think that American companies or Japanese or the British or anybody else, I don't think that they're afraid of competition. I think what's happened is that for a very long time, and I can speak for the United States, and for a U.S. perspective anyway, a very long time we believed that we could tolerate, right, intellectual property theft, or forced, coercive technology transfer, or, an uneven level playing, an uneven playing field when it comes to, access to the Chinese market, right, or Chinese subsidy state-owned enterprises, because we believed that over time China was going to develop in a way that would change all those things, right? So it would develop along the same lines as other countries. I think what Xi Jinping has signaled to much of the rest of the world is that that's not going to happen, or at least not right now. And the Chinese economy is the second largest in the world. It is the most powerful trading power in the world. And so it can no longer be looked upon as simply another developing country where we're kind of hoping for the best, right? It is a fierce competitor that is not, right, developing a level playing field. It's not free and open and fair trade and investment. And I think that is what this reaction is all about. It's simply too big and too developed now. And it's still operating under those same principles, right? You shouldn't have to wait 40 years, right, for China to learn how to protect intellectual property. So I think that is really what's going on here. I don't think it's about a fear of competition. You know, the U.S. already competes against amazing German companies and Japanese companies, right? You don't see these companies doing the same. You don't see the U.S. doing this to those countries, right?
I guess that there was tolerance for IP violations and joint venturing and other conditions of market entry for U.S. companies and others to access the China market. But perhaps in hindsight, Liz, was it a mistake? Shouldn't we have addressed these issues of IP violation, equal access 15 years ago and not now, once China has crossed the line and become the powerhouse that it has become?
You know, I think there's certainly an argument to be made that we should have taken steps earlier. I think a lot of people would agree with you there. And I probably don't disagree, but that's not what happened. And so, it doesn't really make sense to argue now that, oh, well, because we didn't take these steps earlier, we shouldn't take them now. The point is that we must take them now, right? Yeah. That the stakes have only grown larger. And that, again, that Xi Jinping he's been a game changer, right, in the sense that the direction in which he's moved the Chinese economy has not been one to suggest, you know, reform and opening up. And I think, frankly, this is not only something that the Europeans and the Americans and the international community that they're complaining about. You have a very sizable group of reform economists within China who are unhappy with the failure to move forward on structural economic reform in the country. So, you know, there have been people who've been writing about this. There was a major meeting of these reform economists in October where several people were very vocal about their unhappiness with the Xi government, right, and the excessive level of state intrusion into the economy, and the fact that many of the reforms that had been promised back at the third plenum of the 18th Party Congress and the fall of 2013, that none of them has come to fruition. So this is not just a matter of, you know, the outside world saying China needs to reform. This is a matter of the, you know, leading thinkers, leading economic thinkers within China saying this as well.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia and my conversation with Elizabeth Economy, Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author most recently of The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Now it's time for the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the program when I try to sum up the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard and offer a few thoughts of my own. In this episode, we're left with more questions than answers, and that's due in large part to the opaque nature of Trump's China policy. Can we really see in Trump's stance toward the Chinese anything approaching a coherent foreign policy? Without a doubt, how the U.S. played China over the past two decades has much to do with the current predicament. If we were to pick a point of time when the trouble began, you might look to December 2001. That's when China joined the World Trade Organization. Initially, it felt like a coup. Having China join the club felt like a good thing for all. But to make it happen, the U.S. and other members made some big concessions. China lost no time working it to its advantage. There have been other issues as well, chief among them the failure to police intellectual property infringements. Initially, in order to access the China market, MNCs were prepared to look the other way. But now that China has achieved superpower status with ambitious plans to compete globally, MNCs aren't so happy. Finding that policy reset button should be a top priority. U.S.-China tensions are far-reaching and go well beyond trade disputes and economic differences. Global security is at risk as well. A militarized China isn't good for anyone except maybe for China. And what of the North Korea question? Can Trump legitimately expect to make any progress on the Korean Peninsula without China's diplomatic participation? I guess it should come as no surprise that the Trump administration prefers a hardball approach, and Liz isn't in complete disagreement with this. Maybe it's the kind of posturing that China understands. Is it possible that some combination of bullying and a semi-incoherent strategy might just work on the path to leveling the playing field? For me, I'm a little skeptical. Maybe more than a little. In the aftermath of the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, it caught a number of Trump high-level officials completely by surprise. Most couldn't say or wouldn't comment as to whether this was part and parcel of the Trump-China strategy or not. That says to me that there likely is no strategy. In that regard, the arrest of Huawei's CFO is really no different from the American Justice Department's lining up on the border to stop the progress of much demonized caravan of immigrants looking for asylum. In other words, there is no coordination between law and policy. At the present moment in the United States, politically expedient xenophobia is never far from the surface question that toughness is needed, but aware also of the different agendas it could serve. The second question, of course, speaks to China's plan and intent. My guest sees Xi Jinping as a game changer, working to recalibrate the West's perception of China. Can we still believe the story we once told ourselves about how economic liberalization will result in an opening up of the Chinese economy? Probably not. What I continue to come back to in my conversation with Liz is her observation that Xi faces his own challenges at home. Xi's installation of himself as president for life began a process of dissent and discontent that may, in fact, be more widespread than we think, and which may end up coming to a head at a moment when the Chinese economy seems to be slowing. There's no question that Xi is at the crossroads, but what now? Does he lash out and drum up support internally, or does he modify his stance? It's hard to know or be sure about anything, except that this is not the moment to stop watching. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.